This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to this week's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today it's time for a potpourri of science and nutrition and health stories. From time to time here on Intelligent Medicine, we kind of mix it up and provide you with a smorgasbord of different subjects, and that's precisely what we're going to do today. Also in lieu of the fact that I had a pre-recorded show on this weekend because it was Passover and Easter. So I got lots and lots of material to share with you, so settle back, and we'll tackle some of the most important health and nutrition stories of the week. Of interest this week, actually came out last week in the New York Times, there's been a lot of discussion about a recent article by Dean Ornish. It was an op-ed in the New York Times, and in fairness to the New York Times, they've also published op-eds by defenders of meat and saturated fat in the person of Nina Teicholz, who we've interviewed here on Intelligent Medicine. We did a podcast with her, I believe it was last year, about her book, A Big Fat Surprise. And for balance, and I think that this is correct because we need to have a dialogue, the New York Times published an op-ed by Dean Ornish, who I respect very much. He's done a lot for the field. He's, I think, very sincere and very well motivated. But he marshals facts in a way such that he buttresses his argument that fat is bad, red meat is bad. We all ought to be on vegan or quasi-vegan diets, which are very low fat and include lots and lots of whole grains and starchy vegetables. This, I think, is wrong, and I actually wrote an article which talks about this and did an entire podcast, so you can check those out at drhoffman.com. Check out my podcast on the subject of Dean Ornish's article, and I think I thoroughly rebut it in about 45 minutes. But this is sort of an aftershock from that op-ed, which again was published in the New York Times, and it is entitled "Red Meat is Not the Enemy." You may have seen it because it's got a picture of a big cut of red meat front and center in the article, big T-bone steak. And it's written by Aaron E. Carroll, who I don't know, and I don't know what kind of credentials he has, but he makes some good points in the article. And one of the most important points that he makes is that many people quote what is considered a landmark article which suggests that too much protein is bad for you. And so he took the time to drill down and look at that article, and he writes, "I've seen that many people point to a study from last year that found that increased protein intake was associated with large increases in death rates from all diseases, with high increases in the chance of death from cancer or diabetes." He continues, "A close examination of the manuscript, though, tells a different story." And this is why you can't just read the headlines. Sometimes you have to get down in the trenches, and it's boring work, and that's what I get paid to do, is hunker down and read the actual original studies, because sometimes the headline is different than the text. And if you look at the actual study, it's a cohort study of people followed through something called NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. It's a huge study. And actually, you misrepresent the study by saying that it shows that protein is associated with large increases in death rates from all diseases. That is absolutely not what this study shows. In fact, on the contrary, It found that there were no associations between protein consumption and death from all causes, or cardiovascular disease, or cancer, when all participants over age 50 were considered. It did detect a small association between the consumption of protein and diabetes, but the researchers cautioned that this was, you know, maybe due to chance. You know, even though there's maybe a trend, it just may not be statistically significant. Okay. If you look at people over the age of 65, it turns out that higher protein intake was associated with lower levels of all-cause and cancer-specific death. The only group, strangely enough, and it's hard to explain why this might be, where protein intake was associated with higher risk, and that's where they got this from, was people age 50 to 65. Okay? So if you're under 50 or over 65, more protein was good for you. But somehow, if you were 50 to 65, more protein wasn't good for you. So go figure. And so if you're really going to sincerely report on this, and that's what I mean by cherry picking. I think people marshal facts to buttress their arguments. Dean Ornish should have pointed out that it may be true that people from 50 to 65, if we base all our conclusions on this one study, should be eating less protein. Okay, fine. I guess that might be me. But in 3 years, I got to flip the script when I'm 65 and start increasing my protein intake. Doesn't make any sense. And this will help to reduce all-cause and cancer-specific death. So if you think that protein is somehow linked to cancer, some people, you know, they invoke the theory that protein drives the production of something called IGF-1 in the body. IGF-1 is insulin-dependent growth factor, and IGF-1 is associated with certain cancers, particularly prostate cancer. So they're saying, okay, protein drives that. Well, it apparently didn't in these individuals over 65, which is precisely the age where the vast majority of people get cancer. It's very dramatic when people under 65 get cancer and their life is prematurely curtailed. But the vast majority of people get cancer post 65. That's when a higher protein is associated with a lower cancer risk. And to be sincere, you should advise people over the age of 65 to eat more meat. And, you know, basically, we're not saying that. So, what's interesting too, this is based on NHANES data from this large survey that. If you take the same data and you analyze it for meat consumption, the same data in a different study, because what they do is that you just have all this data and then you statisticians pour over it and then they create a study. And then other statisticians with access to the same data analyze it and create a study. Well, other statisticians took a look at the same data and they concluded that meat consumption is not associated with death at all. So, you know, of interest is this guy, Aaron Carroll, cites an interesting article, which I recall reading a couple of years ago, which is a fascinating article. I'm going to share it with you. And it is entitled, "Is Everything We Eat Associated with Cancer? A Systematic Cookbook Review." Now, this is not a joke. This is in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which is the world's foremost cancer journal. And what they say here is that nutritional epidemiology is a highly prolific field. There are lots and lots of studies. Everybody's trying to, you know, maybe they've got their own theory that they're trying to prove. And so they analyze data, you know, like some people want to prove that the Mediterranean diet is, you know, better. And generally, that's what studies point to. Or perhaps researchers from Japan will point out that a diet that is rich in soy or rich in fish is beneficial. Everybody's got, you know, their own slant. The authors of the study say debates on associations of nutrients with disease risk are common in the literature and attract attention in public media. Yeah, they sure do. Public media like this program, right? But also now, you know, I think if you look at the way the Times looked 30 years ago, there wasn't a lot of health reporting. Now there's an entire science section. There's big sections in all the major papers. Everybody's fascinated with studies and research, especially when it pertains to something as germane to our lives as diet, exercise, lifestyle. You know, so they're looking for relevant studies. They're not looking for, you know, studies about mouse DNA and, you know, blah, blah, blah. About. That's not interesting. But when you look at a study and it says, whoa, you eat more meat and you're going to die, hey, that's going to get your attention. So anyway, these guys did something interesting. They selected 50 common ingredients from random recipes in a cookbook. That's how they were assured that it was random process. And then they did literature inquiries about recent studies that evaluated the relationship of each ingredient to cancer risk. Here's what they found. 40 ingredients, that's out of 50, for a resounding 80% had articles reporting on their cancer risk. Okay, this is from a cookbook, an ordinary cookbook. We're not talking, you know, like a toxic waste dump cookbook, but an ordinary cookbook. 40 ingredients, that's 8 out of 10, or 80%, had articles reporting on their cancer risk. Of 264 single study assessments, 191, that's 72%, concluded that the tested food was associated with increased risk of cancer, or possibly a decreased risk of cancer. So what they're saying is that associated with cancer risk or benefits have been claimed for most food ingredients. That's true, because it's 8 out of 10. They're not saying that all those foods cause cancer. They're saying that some of the foods actually may have prevented cancer. And then, you know, that's certainly, we would talk about here. Maybe if they're talking about ingredients like turmeric, you know, curry, certainly, or the omega-3 in fish, and so on and so on and so on. So they say in this introduction, randomized trials have repeatedly failed to find treatment effects for nutrients in which observational studies had previously proposed strong associations. And such discrepancies in the evidence have fueled hot debates rife with emotional and sensational rhetoric that can subject the general public to increased anxiety. Yeah, that's you, the general public. You're getting more anxious. These studies can subject the general public, they say, to increased anxiety and contradictory advice. One wonders whether this, and I'm reading from the article here, one wonders whether this highly charged atmosphere and intensive testing of food-related associations may create a plethora of false positive findings and questionable research practices, especially when the research is highly exploratory. The analyses and protocols aren't pre-registered and the findings are selectively reported. Yeah, there's a lot of selective reporting because, you know, everybody comes with a bias. And certainly, you know, you're going to get a study from Dean Ornish. You're going to get one opinion. You're going to get a study from Lauren Cordain, the paleo diet guy. You're going to get some other conclusions and so on. Give you some examples. They found that the ingredients selected from random recipes were the following: veal, salt, pepper, spice, flour, egg, bread, pork, butter, tomato, lemon, duck, onion, celery, carrot, parsley, mace, sherry, olive, mushroom, tripe, milk, cheese, coffee, bacon, sugar, lobster, potato. Does lobster cause cancer? Potato, beef, lamb, mustard, nuts, wine, peas, corn, cinnamon, cayenne, orange, tea, rum, and raisin. What they found was that there was a lot of variation and there was a lot of contradictory evidence. So what they conclude is that is ultimately that nutritional epidemiology is a valuable field that it can identify potentially modifiable risk factors related to diet. However, the credibility of studies in this and other fields is subject to publication and other selective outcome and analysis reporting biases. They're hoping that we can come up with answers, but a sensible approach would be to follow what this guy, Aaron Carroll, is saying in the New York Times, he's saying the bottom line, it may not be one single food culprit. The simple problem is we eat more than we need to eat, whether it's red meat or carbs or sugar or fat altogether. I mean, it all adds up to excess, and probably that's the single biggest problem that we should be focusing on. And, oh, by the way, our consumption of, here's another important fact. A lot of people point to red meat as the culprit. Well, actually, our intake of red meat has declined. That's a fact. You know, you're entitled to your opinions, but not to your facts. Actually, studies show that our intake over the last few years, partly the result of a successful campaign to stigmatize meat as being bad for you, our consumption of red meat has declined, and we haven't seen a resounding improvement in our cardiovascular numbers. Some people report slight improvements, but that may be due to widespread adoption of statins or more access to preventive treatments in cardiology. But one thing for sure, our consumption of carbohydrates like grain and sugar has been on the rise. This is partly the unforeseen consequence of our obsession with avoiding fats and red meat. And that's not good, ultimately. So anyway, that's the perspective from Aaron Carroll in the Times, and I thought I'd share that with you. Now let's take a look at the simmering debate about calcium. Is it harmful to the heart? And this actually came up due to an article that appeared a little while ago. In 2010, a guy did a meta-analysis of 15 different studies, and he found that people who received calcium supplements had a statistically significant 30% increase in the incidence of myocardial infarction. And, you know, most of the people who listen to this podcast are very, very attuned to developments in the field of nutrition. So this created widespread panic and consternation among supplement consumers, many of them believing that calcium, you know, formerly highly advisable, was all of a sudden extremely dangerous. And I urge caution around that issue. But I also have long been saying that we have been urging, especially women, to consume too much calcium. We've told women they need to consume 1,500 or 2,000 of calcium per day, lots and lots of dairy products. A recent study shows that high consumption of milk, as is often advised to women for protecting their bones, not only doesn't protect against osteoporosis, but high consumption of milk is associated with a threefold higher risk of dying. Whoa, what's up with that? Is it about calcium or is it about something inherent in milk? That is unclear. But recently, researchers revisited the issue of calcium and the heart. And I'll read you one study. This is a study looking at rheumatoid arthritis patients who did not have coronary artery disease. And although rheumatoid arthritis patients are highly likely to get cardiovascular disease because inflammation in their joints predicts inflammation in their arteries, and they do have a higher risk of cardiac events. But anyway, they in this study, they took people who had not yet shown obvious signs of cardiovascular disease. They then looked at the amount of supplemental calcium that they were consuming, and they also measured their coronary artery calcium. And they explored the association between calcium consumption and coronary artery calcification. Among the 145 rheumatoid arthritis patients studied, 28% took a lot of calcium, greater than 1,000 milligrams per day of supplemental calcium. And that's because, in addition to cardiovascular disease, patients with rheumatoid arthritis are also at more risk for osteoporosis. So they're taking lots of supplemental calcium, 28% of them. And what they found was that, paradoxically, high scores in coronary artery calcification were significantly less frequent in the high supplemental calcium group than in the lower dosed group. So that's kind of interesting. It's like the opposite fun. Not only was calcium not associated with higher calcification, it is the opposite. It seems to be possibly protective, but certainly of no consequence in terms of coronary artery calcification. So they conclude that higher levels of oral calcium supplementation were not associated with an increased risk of coronary atherosclerosis as measured by a coronary artery calcification score, which is a test that I use at the Hoffman Center to establish cardiovascular risk in this group of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, you may say, well, that's just one study, and it's in rheumatoid arthritis patients. I'm still concerned that all that calcium that I'm consuming by mouth, instead of finding its way to my bones, it's going to find its way to my arteries. And one of the things we sometimes discuss is the role of vitamin K2 plays in helping to act as kind of a crossing guard to send calcium to the right place, away from your arteries and towards your bones. And it appears it might protect the arteries while enhancing the efficacy of calcium and vitamin D to enhance bone density. That's one point that's worth making. But here's another. This is a study of studies. It's called a meta-analysis. It was done on 18 randomized controlled trials, comprising a total of, get this, nearly 64,000 participants. So that's a lot of people. It's not just one study. That's 18 studies. And here's what they found. They found that there was no impact of calcium supplementation on heart disease-related mortality or even all-cause mortality in this group of individuals who are mostly elderly women. Okay, which is, yeah, that's the group that you're concerned about, because those are the big takers of calcium. Men are less likely to take tons of calcium supplementally because, although they are at risk for osteoporosis, they're generally less at risk. They get it later. So that's pretty good news for consumers of calcium. On the other hand, I have, over the years, reduced the amount of calcium that is in my products. In foundation formula, you'll find a modest amount of calcium. There's a little bit. And in my osteosupport, some people, when I first came out with that, they said, what are you doing? You're making a bone-supportive nutrient, and that's supposed to have, 1,200 or 1,500 of calcium. How can you shortchange people? And the way I answered is, I said, there's a moderate amount in there. But what's more important is the vitamin D and the vitamin K and the cofactors, like the isoflavones, and the various things like manganese and lysine and boron and silica, which act as cofactors for bone formation. It's not just, obviously taking tons and tons of calcium, it's not going to find its way to your bones if you don't have the proper cofactors for the calcium to do its job. But nonetheless, we can rest a little easier. And a little background is that the guy who did the original study, I believe he's from New Zealand, that showed the dangers of calcium supplementation, he's a kind of an anti-supplement guy. He also is a guy who's trying to debunk the efficacy of vitamin D, which certainly deserves recognition for its important role in osteoporosis prevention. So I would take the advice to severely limit calcium with a grain of salt. All right. That concludes part one of today's podcast. We got lots more in part two. We'll share some of the latest stories on the health front with you when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.